Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
story of arriving, not being accepted, and having to work hard and winning over the Australian society. This is the story of migration told through the Italian lens. But that migrant story is similar to so many other cultures.
We take a look at the history of Italian female migrants and the contribution they've made to Australian culture. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first... the landmark deal set to be agreed upon with the governments of Australia and Papua New Guinea on a new defence pact appears to be stalled. The pact would have seen both countries actively cooperating in military exercises, as well as the exchange of troops between the two nations. The pact will also see the two countries come to the aid of one another when faced with conflict. Anthony Albanese was upbeat about the prospect.
This is about advancing the sovereignty and security of both of our nations.
But now the PNG cabinet appears to be having second thoughts. Could there be foreign interference? Anthony Albanese downplayed the roadblock.
Australia is ready to go, but of course we have to go through our processes as well.
In light of 50 years of PNG independence, James Bale asked Ian Kemish of the School of Historical and Philosophical Inquiry at the University of Queensland and former High Commissioner to PNG about the new pact that would further strengthen the diplomatic ties between the two nations.
Well, it was the largest and most significant of Australia's overseas territories. At the time of independence, Papua New Guinea was a country of 2 to 3 million. It's something like 12 to 15 these days. And it was an integrated part of the Commonwealth of Australia, administered from Canberra.
In the past 50 years, what has been the biggest successes in Australia's diplomatic ties with the country?
I think there's one core thing to call out here, and that is that Australia has stayed the distance and remained by far Papua New Guinea's most significant partner. There's lots of talk about other countries. China gets mentioned a lot, but plenty of others as well. In the end, you put together all of the financial assistance that every other country or organisation in the world gives to Papua New Guinea, it makes about a tenth of what Australia provides.
Speaking upon the defence treaty, how is that significant in deterring the influences of outside powers?
Well, we're going to have to see what this agreement actually says. It's an interesting situation. We've seen quite a bit of reporting, including by the ABC. The narrative that we're seeing in the media is that it will involve a level of integration between our respective forces, and that there'll also be some commitments to support each other in times of conflict. From Australia's point of view, that's all very good. The last time war came close to our shores here in Australia in 1942, it came through the occupation of Papua New Guinea, which in the end is only 3.6 kilometres from the nearest Queensland island. It's very, very close. So in any imaginable scenario, it would be a no-brainer for us to come to the defence of Papua New Guinea if it was under attack from a significant ex-regional power.
When it does come to the sharing of military personnel and troops between the two nations, what will be some of the biggest implications that could happen?
Interoperability is really important. I think that building on the personal links that already have existed for decades now between the Papua New Guinea Defence Force and the ADF will be important. Papua New Guinea has struggled, given its budget and its organisational arrangements, to maintain its military to a level that government and people in Papua New Guinea are satisfied with. One of the things that will have to be managed is that it won't see reduction in personnel and capacity on the PNGDF side in favour of the Australian side. Bougainville is an interesting one. When the Bougainville War in the 1990s, the biggest conflict in the Pacific since the Second World War and saw thousands of people killed, was a civil war in Papua New Guinea between separatists on the island of Bougainville and the government of Papua New Guinea. We were, through those years, maintaining our defence cooperation program. And there were things that had to be managed at that time. There were perceptions that some of our materiel, equipment, and helicopters and things were being used by PNG Defence Force in this conflict against the Bougainvillians. And so there's some Bougainvillians who still think that we were kind of on one side in that situation. I think the government of the day did their best to manage those things.
Many key figures in Papua New Guinea's government and military have expressed their concern over the pact, saying it damages the sovereignty of the nation. What could the pact entail to ensure that it's not hindered?
I think people are talking at the moment without a lot of knowledge about what the pact actually says. And yes, absolutely, Papua New Guinea is a robust democracy, and there were people who will be questioning this and that, just as there were all sorts of questions asked at the time that the United States sealed a status of forces agreement with Papua New Guinea, you know, in recent years. There's a bit of selectivity happening here, and I think the media is finding people who have something different to say about the agreement, and that's being telegraphed a little bit in public narrative. But generally speaking, I think that we can celebrate the fact that PNG is still a democracy. It is still a place where people can have different views and express them clearly and openly in public about their own government's approach, something that is outstanding about Papua New Guinea, and sign that the values and approach in PNG is still very closely aligned with that of Australia, and that some of those concerns in the region about Chinese influence and its effect on freedom of expression have not been realised in PNG.
Ian Kemish from the University of Queensland there, and also a former High Commissioner to Papua New Guinea, speaking there with James Bale.
Hey there, we're the Warren Miller Band, and you're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
A dark chapter in Australian public administration has reached a turning point with a massive $548 million settlement in the RoboDebt class action lawsuit. Whilst this provides some financial relief for over 430,000 victims, big questions about justice still remain. Thomas Kutis asked Dr. Christopher Rudge, lecturer in law at the University of Sydney, whether this feels like enough compensation for the victims.
So yes, the RoboDebt scandal was a terrible event and one of the most tragic errors in governance in Australian history. And for the victims, it's undoubtedly a day of financial vindication and validation after a long and terrible ordeal, waiting and people suffering and enduring psychiatric harm. However, we must be careful not to confuse the headline figure in relation to this settlement with generosity. Although this is the largest settlement in Australian history, it's just a reflection of the enormous size of the cohort, which numbers 433,000 people, rather than the generosity of payments to the individuals.
A key part of this case was the claim that public officials deliberately misused their power. Can you briefly explain why that accusation is so serious?
Yeah, so in this second class action, which was an appeal of the first, in which the plaintiffs, who were victims of RoboDebt, brought a claim of misfeasance in public office against the government and the public servants. This particular claim is incredibly serious because it's the only legal wrong that applies to public officials who misuse their power. However, to prove this claim, you have to show that the public officials were more than simply incompetent. You have to show that the public officials had a specific state of mind and what the law has called conscious maladministration. You needed to show that the public officials consciously did the wrong thing. Now, the plaintiffs were very confident that they could prove this claim, and obviously the government defendant was prepared to settle on the basis of the evidence they foresaw coming. So it's a very serious accusation, But in this case, it looks like it would have been successful. Otherwise, one might ask, why did the government settle?
Because this was settled out of court, you've said we might never get the full story. What is the most important thing we now won't find out?
Well, robo-debt was, as the Royal Commission found, a terrible error that the government kind of imposed on citizens. The key question that remains unanswered was whether those who designed the scheme and who were responsible for its continued administration through many complaints and many administrative appeal tribunals declaring that it was unlawful or at least questionable, the question remaining was whether they did this on purpose. Did anyone in the public service have knowledge of the illegality or unlawfulness of the scheme and continue without any change in their decision making or in their processes? And with that, with the case now settled and the claims dropped, we will never be able to examine that question, whether public servants knowingly acted unlawfully.
Many victims want to see the individuals behind robo-debt held responsible. Is there still any chance of that happening in the future?
Well, we have one last clear chance, and that lies with the National Anti-Corruption Commission. So the NAC has committed, after many false steps, to investigating six persons who were referred to it by the Royal Robo-Debt Royal Commission and Commissioner Catherine Holmes. The allegations or circumstances in which those referrals have arisen is still a secret. The details are contained in a sealed section of the Robo-Debt Royal Commission report, and NAC would now have in its possession those details, and it may be conducting private hearings right now. So we await the results of any such private hearings. I would be very keen for public hearings to take place, but the NAC doesn't need to do those. If all goes as well as it can, the NAC will make findings that one or more or all of the six referred individuals engaged in corruption, which is defined as a breach of the public trust, when they were administering the robo-debt scheme.
How can we make sure that this corruption doesn't happen again?
Well, I think that it is actually very likely that something like robo-debt could occur again. But to avoid it, we really need to see a complete paradigm shift in the way that we approach welfare in Australia and the social security system. The principle, I think, should be espoused within the Department of Human Services, now Services Australia, and the Departments of Social Security, is that there is almost negligible fraud in the system, and a working assumption should be that people are entitled to the support they receive.
Dr. Christopher Rudge, lecturer in law at the University of Sydney, speaking there with Thomas Kutters.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
An arts or humanities degree is more expensive than ever, costing an average of $50,000. Yet across Australian universities, they're being cut more than ever. Despite what universities and the government believe, experts say that the practical skills of an arts and humanities education should not be underestimated in the workforce. Amelia Crouch asked History Professor and Head of the Australian Historical Association, Michelle Arrow, why courses in these disciplines are being disproportionately targeted.
It does appear to be that the humanities and social sciences are the particular target of a lot of these cuts in things like teacher education as well as the classical humanities and social sciences. Partly, I think a lot of what's going on at the moment is the result of, partly it's a continuation of a longer sort of pattern of underfunding and cutting of humanities and social sciences in universities. It's been going on really for about 10, 15, 20 years or more, but it's sharpened recently with the introduction of the, under the Morrison government, of what the policy that was called Job Ready Graduates, which kind of basically tried to direct students into particular degrees that the government felt were more job ready than others. And they explicitly said that humanities and social sciences were not job ready. They were not going to give students kind of good employment outcomes. And so fees for those subjects were increased by more than 100%. And I think it's a combination of the fee increases, which of course have reduced the number of students in some of these courses. But it's also, I think, the broader cultural message that that sent, which is that if you want a good job, don't do the arts and social sciences.
Do you think that this scheme implies that the government prioritises certain degrees over others?
Absolutely it does. I mean, it really sent the message that other kinds of graduates were more valuable to the government and more valuable to the nation than humanities and social sciences graduates. And basically what it said is, we will pay more of the cost of your degree if you are doing science, and we will pay far less. In fact, you will almost be paying the entire cost of your degree yourself if you choose to do an art, humanities or social sciences course.
So you teach history, and so why would a course like history or other courses in arts and social sciences in these disciplines, how would they teach practical skills that are valuable to the workforce?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that is emphasised, I think, by a lot of humanities and social sciences scholars is that we face a few big technological challenges. We face the kind of rise of mis and disinformation. We face the kind of looming, emergence of AI as a kind of technique, as a way that is sort of being rolled out as a sort of fait accompli in workplaces. One thing that AI can only do is it can only create things based on existing knowledge. It can't create anything new. And humanities and social sciences research is all about discovery and teaching students how to form their and make their own discovery. All the skills in the humanities and social sciences are really essential for kind of making sure that we engage with AI in a way that is ethical, but also ensures that we still can produce trusted, reliable information. And I think, too, the research and critical thinking skills that people learn in arts and humanities degrees are still incredibly important in the workplace. And they're also transferable. I mean, one of the things we know for young people going into the workforce today is that they will change careers maybe five or six times. And the one thing that I think is really helpful about humanities is that it allows students to pursue their passions and to develop skills at the same time, and skills that can be applied to a range of different careers.
The Job Ready graduate scheme was heavily criticised by Labor at the time, but now there seems to be little kind of emphasis on reforming this scheme. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, when the Australian Historical Association, we wrote an open letter recently that was signed by 100 high-profile graduates of BA degrees, and we really emphasised the way that the Labor, in opposition, emphasised the fact that this was profoundly inequitable and that it was penalising students for pursuing their passions in that area, and that they did kind of talk about reforming that when they got back into government. Now, they've been in government now for more than 3 years. They've been returned at an election and they still haven't done that reform. There's not a lot of votes in university, so, you know, we're not going to win a lot of votes by doing this. Far easier to do a kind of across-the-board debt cut, which is welcome, I'm sure, for some students, but it does nothing for students who are currently enrolled in the system. So it's a really strange thing, I think, that the government hasn't done that. There's been some pressure within the government, within backbenchers particularly, to kind of speed up the reform. But so far it seems that the government is playing a very cautious political game and doesn't want to kind of jump the gun on this, which I think is a real shame, because I think what's happening in universities at the moment with the decimation of humanities and social sciences is that by the time they get around to changing the law, to changing the fee structures around arts and humanities, there may not be a thriving arts, humanities and social sciences sector left for the students to study under.
Professor Michelle Arrow, History Professor and Head of the Australian Historical Association from Macquarie University, speaking there with Amelia Crouch.
Whenever I want to catch up with current affairs in Australia, I head to thewire.org.au or I follow them on Twitter. I just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. And yes, they're on Facebook too.
The legacy of Italian women migrants is chronicled in a new documentary that explores the contribution multiple generations would have upon Australian culture. The documentary La Signorinella, Little Miss, profiles the struggle of migrant women and how they were able to find their way to use their cultural difference to reach the very top of business, agriculture, fashion and entertainment. Stephen Hill asked the film's co-director, Shannon Swan, about the appeal of this cohort of migrant women.
I think we're all influenced by the migrant influx into our country. It's not that long ago that we had the White Australia policy. It was just a nice time to reflect on their journey and celebrate.
So there's a lot of history that might not be that well known by many Australians, such as the internment camps during World War II that housed detained migrants. And in the documentary, you interview the many women who were forced to work the hard labour of cutting cane and picking grapes to ensure their family farm survived. Do you think that this contribution of these women in agriculture is often overlooked?
That story, it was a complete surprise to me. And I remember flying up to Brisbane to chat to Mary. I understood that they worked on the farms and things like that. But I had no idea that as soon as World War II started, that they became the enemy overnight. And the Italian men were dragged off to internment camps all over Australia, and the women were left to fend for themselves and kept these farms going for years and years until the men returned. And they worked hard because not only did they have to look after the land, they had to look after the homes as well.
So when it comes to cuisine, having experienced different tastes provided an opportunity for a range of what would become Italian restaurateurs and people who would work in the food industry. You know, you discovered that many Italian migrants were able to find a hole in the market to the rather bland British meat and three veg. Can you talk a bit about the contribution Italian migrants would have towards changing the diet of many Australians?
I think it was a bit of a blank canvas. We were pretty basic in what we ate. And there's a quote from Olympia Bortolotto, who runs quite a few restaurants in Melbourne, that she says, "I just thought what we're doing was normal." You know, all these foods, that the pastas and the sauces that they'd make and the Italian salads that were called weeds at the time and things like that, this was just stuff that came naturally to the Italians. As soon as they started infiltrating the kitchens in the big cities, that's when their influence was really shown. And people would come from everywhere to taste fresh pasta, and you know, they're introduced to squid and calamari and all sorts of different things that they'd never had before. You know, I think secretly spag bol has become the national dish, and we all reckon that we cook the best one. So you can thank the Italian women for that.
Australia has also had waves of migration. First of all, we talked about the Italian and the Greeks, but now we've got, you know, close to a third of the population was born overseas. No longer is it the Australia of "they're a weird mob." We are a vibrant multicultural community. Do you think the story of the Signorella also offers insights for people from other migrant backgrounds?
Yeah, it's definitely a universal story. This is the story of migration told through the Italian lens. But that migrant story is similar to so many other cultures that have come here. That story of arriving, not being accepted, and having to work hard and winning over the Australian society and then becoming part of it and blossoming. And we talk about the Italians, that's the same as the Greek community, lots of people from Eastern Europe that came across. And then we talk about the Vietnamese community that came in the 70s, leading right up to the Sudanese community that's arriving now, and they're having their problems with racism and assimilation. But hopefully we can use this as a document of history of how it works and how the migrant experience hopefully plays out for all the new migrants that arrive. And hopefully as Australians, we can learn a little bit about being more tolerant and accepting of our new arrivals.
So you also mentioned the contribution Italian migrants would have upon the world of media and entertainment, being particularly influential in the development of SBS.
That's an incredible story. And basically, at the time, you just couldn't get any Italian news. I think there was one newspaper in Sydney and one in Melbourne, but the idea of hearing an Italian voice on the radio was just impossible. So with El Grasby, who was the Minister for Communication, he came in and he got a group of migrant women together that helped form 2EA. And that basically came on to be SBS, and that was transmitted in 64 different languages. Imagine being a migrant that's feeling a little lost in our community here, not Italian enough, not Australian enough, and then get to hear your own language on the radio and then seeing it on TV. It was just an amazing thing to accomplish. When SBS started in 1980, it was a world first and something completely unique. Once again, we've got to thank the Italian women who were behind that, gave their time for free and really drove that.
So how hard was it to gather archival material? Did that take a lot of work?
You get archive from several different sources. The National Film and Sound Archive is incredible. And with the help of Lisa Savage, who is just the archive goat in this country, she helps track that down. And then the other side might be broadcast material. And then there's private material. So what would happen is that, say, you go to someone's house, you have a coffee to start off with, which is kind of, you know, the Italian thing to do. And then you do the interview. And then usually afterwards, they'll bring a box of stuff out. And, you know, it's kind of like Christmas. You open this parcel and you never quite know what you're going to get. And it might be photos, you know, from the 30s or 40s. It might be an old DVD that might be a Super 8 from the 60s that hasn't even been developed. Archive comes from all sorts of different places. And it's one of those things that's just a complete surprise every time, but brings those moments and scenes back to life.
Co-director Shannon Swan of the documentary La Signorinella, Little Miss, speaking there with Stephen Hill. This film is premiering at the Italian Film Festival around Australia. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.